session number 7304, Reel 4.
Colonel King, Reel 4. You were saying that the maps you had were no good and that your information about the local terrain came from native policemen and other officials under the control of their civilian officers. Did they manage to gather any information about the enemy and what they were doing?
Yes, they did. You see, the civilian officers were... A lot of them were district commissioners. And they had an... Although they were back in... they were in uniform as a sort of territorials of the Sudan Defense Force, they were still acting in their capacity as district commissioners, dealing with offences, dealing with tribal problems, and things like that. And so a whole time into their little camp, whatever you like to call it, people used to come. They used to mete out punishments to the chap who came from over the border with a herd of goats or camels or whatever it was. They used to mete out punishments to these people and find them. And it's through those sort of sources that we got the information. Because when you've got a chap who just come, should we say, from Karora there, and walked over the border, because these were nomadic people who didn't, border meant nothing to them, used to come in there. I mean, the district commissioner would say, well, now tell us, what is there in Karora in the way of Italian troops or colonial troops? And, I mean, you get a certain amount of information. And the other thing was that up in the hills there, these chaps knew the tracks up into the hills, and you could go up the hills there, following one of these tracks, and overlook Karora. Similarly, later on, could overlook Elgena. And you could watch, get quite close to where the Italians were, and look through binoculars and see what was going on. This is the way you got your intelligence. It's all very local intelligence, all very local. I mean, what was happening in Khartoum or anything else like that, one, of course, didn't get from those people. One got that from the normal intelligence. One got through one's battalion headquarters and one's brigade headquarters.
But it sounds though you were well integrated into the local native gossip network.
Oh, one was. Yes, it's perfectly true. And one couldn't do without it.
How did your troops get on with the natives in the Sudan?
Round the Suakin area, there was the ordinary Sudanese chap who was on the plains and in Suakin itself, in the markets with his herds and goats and things like that. On the other side, and they were mainly Tigray. I think they were called T-I-G-R-E, Tigray. Yeah. Now, as you gone up into the foothills, you got the real Fuzzy Wuzzy, who still went there with a shield and a spear and a mop of hair. And I think they were called Hadendar.
They were now, followers of the Mahdi.
That's right. Now, they were a very proud. They would not communicate. If you turned up in their village, they would take no notice of you at all. They wouldn't be aggressive, but they would take no notice. They would just ignore you.
So just aloof.
That's right. Entirely aloof. Because when we were up in the hills from time to time when we were training there, you used to come across one of their water holes in a wadi, and you would find the women drawing water. As soon as we arrived there, the women would disappear. And along the next thing you'd find is out of the scrub came three or four chaps looking very vicious with spears and things like that. They wouldn't take any notice of you. They were just there to see that you didn't interfere, probably with the soldiers interfere with their women. And that they could go on watering their goats and cattle, because they had some cattle there. So you had the two different. With those sort of people, they hadn't died. I mean, you had no association at all. With the Sudanese, you did. And if you could communicate with them, I mean, we did have the odd person who could speak enough Arabic to be able to talk to them. And some of them spoke in Swakin itself, so some English.
But did the troops' attitude to the Sudanese differ from their attitude to the Egyptians in the Canal Zone?
Oh, yes. I mean, they thought much more of the Sudanese than they did the Egyptian. I regret to say, but I mean, the Jippy was the Jippy. The Sudanese were very different people.
Why do you think that was?
First of all, I mean, we came across Sudan Defence Force, and you could not compare the quality of the soldier in the Sudan Force and the quality of the soldier in the Egyptian army. And one's got to remember, I haven't mentioned this before, but one's got to remember the fact that we trained before the war in Fayed, where we used to go off for annual training, with the Egyptian army. And at one stage, to such an extent, that we supplied a company to an Egyptian battalion in Fayed, and they supplied a company to the British battalion, our battalion there. And I mean, there was no doubt about it. I mean, the Egyptians were not very efficient. I think the soldiers weren't bad, but the officers were quite awful that time, those days.
What was wrong with the Egyptian officers?
Well, I think, first of all, that rank went by weight. That's the first thing.
Or perhaps weight went by rank.
Or perhaps weight went by rank. And the Reshid soldier was badly paid. His morale was low. The officers were just useless, I thought.
What about the Sudanese? How did they...
Oh, they're very different. The Sudan army didn't... You see, the Sudan... the only soldiers we came across in the Sudan, I mean, were the Sudan Defence Force, because there wasn't anything else. So the Sudan Defence Force and this volunteer force there that were created during the war, and they were jolly good. Because, as I say, they were mostly disciplined. In fact, the Sudan Defence Force was very highly disciplined. But the irregular force, the Meadow Force, they were disciplined people. You had your district commissioners and similar people on top, and then you had the soldiers of the thing there, who were largely, as I say, policemen, Sudan police. And local police, recruited locally, so they could we could use them as guides and use their knowledge of the country and use their knowledge of the local inhabitants. Tremendous people.
You mentioned that you were exercising up in the hills above Suakin. What sort of tactical exercises were you doing mainly?
Well, we knew that where we would have to operate when we moved down to Eritrea would probably be in the hills, in the mountains. And therefore, one had to get the soldiers used to the mountains and the hills. Because don't forget, the battalion had been in the desert, the western desert, flat as a pancake. And one reckoned one would have to. So one had to get used to the hills. That's the first thing. And therefore, your tactics were entirely different. Because tops of hills were important, but so were the routes through the hills, the mountains, using the wadis, tracks, things like that. And the other thing was cover. In the western desert, one hadn't had any cover. Now you were cover. You had scrub trees. You had one in the wadis. You had quite big trees, and you had a cover from fissures in the ground, and quite high hills. Well, very high hills. And so, I mean, the whole thing, one was very much more back to, for my term, a European type of warfare in a place like, Wales, if you like. Something like that. Hilly, mountainous.
So it was a re-education process.
Re-education was the training. You're absolutely right.
When you were up in these hills, were you, was the emphasis upon offensive tactics or upon defence?
Offensive all the time. Offensive all the time. Defence by night. Because one had to appreciate straight away there that one's knowledge was so slight and one had no maps really to work off that you did not at that time. At night you stopped and you got into a defensive position. But by day you advanced. The whole idea was to advance, go down eventually through Eritrea using the route as your centre line and tearing that route down.
And were the basic tactical concepts the same as in Europe, to wit, things such as always attempting an envelopment when in an attack,
yes,
using fire and movement? Yes.
Well, unfortunately, that time is unfortunate. One didn't know the tactics so much of the Italians and how they would operate. One didn't even know what their defensive positions were like. Well, one got a certain amount of it from aerial photographs. Well, not aerial photographs so much, but maps that were produced from aerial photographs in a later stage, may I say. Not initially, because, as I say, you had these cloth maps to start with.
But the battalion must have had collectively some sort of opinion of the Italians, having met them in the Western Desert.
Yes, and this perhaps was a bit dangerous. But later on, we found the Italians in Eritrea were just side tougher and better than the Italians in the Western Desert. I mean, for example, around Keren, we didn't meet them at the time, but the remainder, two other brigades in the division, met the Savoy Grenadiers, who fought like hell. Extremely good. And their colonial troops there were well officered on the whole. And whilst the officers were still there, and some NCOs and warrant officers, the colonial troops kept going. It's when the officers or the NCOs started to say, we've had it or we're about to have it, and that's when the collapse came, from the colonial troops' point of view. But there were some one or two quite good Italian regiments there.
So can I assume then that you'd got the battalion, not you personally, but the battalion collectively had got a quite a low opinion of the Italians from their experience in the Western Desert?
Yes, definitely. Definitely from the Western Desert. Very low opinion. Perhaps that was a mistake. Mm. And also, later on our first contacts with the Manera Trail, we got a low opinion of them. Until, as I say, the division really hit Keren. And then they got a much more different view of them.
But one could also observe that you wouldn't have had much chance to find out about their tactics in defence from encounters in the Western Desert.
No, none.
So really you were doing general training on the basis of basic principle for a campaign where you would really be feeling your way.
In the hills,
yes.
Yes.
And you were really quite in the dark about what sort of tactics
the
enemy might use to try and stop you.
That's right. The other thing was, when we had to appreciate pretty early, was the fact that you were on a lot of the time on what you might term a one company front. Because, I mean, there was a track or a so-called road like that, and on either side you had very high hills. And you couldn't deploy a battalion on anything more than a company front. Sometimes you'd draw a side less.
I presume the battalion had no previous experience of mountain warfare.
None.
How did they take to operating in these hills or exercising in these hills after they had been in the Western Desert?
Well, in fact, they loved it. They loved it. I mean, their training before, I mean, the older soldiers, the NCOs, who'd been trained, who'd done training in England, places like that, I mean, they were right back much more to European warfare, but perhaps on a slightly steeper hill or a mountain to cope with, but basically the same.
So there are no real difficulties of adjustment. No. I'd like to ask you a bit about the general condition of your company and of the battalion at this stage, because this is the stage when you were preparing for action. What was the strength of the company?
That's a very quick one, which is difficult. I can't remember, but I imagine it's something in the region of 100.
Were you up to strength, or were you seriously short?
Short.
Did you have any reservists or conscripts?
At this time, no. And we were short of NCOs. The reason we were short of NCOs was that in early 1940, in fact, it was in probably late 39, we'd had to send home a lot of NCOs. We had a certain number of officers and quite a lot of NCOs there to the UK for the purpose of going into the Territorial Army, and new battalions were being formed like that, to provide them with NCOs and instructors and things like that. And so we were a bit short of NCOs. And although we'd done a lot of promotion within our own battalion there, comes a limit to an extent when you lose, so we say, six officers and 20 NCOs or whatever it was, to suddenly find 20 senior NCOs take their place, especially on the specialist side of mortar people, machine gun people as one had in those days, signalers.
Was there anything you could do to overcome this difficulty?
None at that time. We were getting no reinforcements. None at all.
Does this mean you had to promote men who are unsuitable?
No, we didn't have to do that. We had to take a chance on promoting people we thought would be suitable, which, by tradition at that time, were rather too young, we thought, to promote. In actual fact, it didn't happen, because we used to think that it took a long time for a soldier to become a sergeant, 10 years perhaps. Well, in actual fact, that was it was nonsense. In 2 years you have an excellent sergeant or less.
So you were promoting men who were inexperienced,
but who got experience very quickly.
Were a majority of your soldiers long service men?
Yes, at that time.
So, would it be fair to say that you knew most of them quite well?
Yes, indeed.
This must have made things much easier if you knew them.
Oh, indeed.
What about officers? Presumably you were short of those also.
We were. We did get a certain number of officers that had come out. When I say we didn't get any drafts, we did. But, I mean, not many, not sufficient to bring the battalion up to strength. And we got some officers out. I would think about, I suppose, during that period of time, I must have had a dozen officers between end of 39 and that period.
Were these reserve officers from the...
Most of them were people who'd served we had Dalton, Ben Dalton, who arrived, who commanded our care platoon later. He was an artist rifle. And he went from artist rifle to an octo and then came to us. We had two or three people like that. We had Domenio, who came out. He was a territorial officer, and so on. Some had experience, some hadn't. Some were absolutely straight out of octo to us.
So you didn't get all your officers from members of the regiment?
No.
How did they settle in? Did they find very it difficult
well. They were mostly from the, put it away, London and the South. I mean, I can't recall that time having any sort of Yorkshire people. Although later we did get the odd one.
But a battalion is really a sort of extended family, isn't
it? Yes. And most of the men, you see, who were in with us at that time, came from London, Surrey or Sussex. Basically most, I suppose a good 60% were Sussex and the rest came from London. Sorry, we had a lot of Londoners.
But I presume they're from south of the river rather than north of the river.
Wouldn't I say, I think some of them were people who'd gone down to Brighton for the summer to work down in Brighton like that, and possibly found that when the winter came there wasn't any job for them, they joined the army. I mean, you know, we did have some of those people.
What about other ranks? Did you have reservists coming to fill up the platoons?
Yes, we did.
And how did they take to being recalled to the colours?
I think they were just... the war on. They knew what they had... what their terms of service were, so many years on the reserve, and they came in. I mean, for example, I remember the CO's driver before the war, there, who went out, poor chap, in about April 19, or somewhere around there, 1939, and was back with us in September 39, having been out of the army for a thing like that, back come on, a CO's driver. Lance Corporal Banks, I remember him well.
Sounds as though they were content to serve, but they weren't overjoyed.
Well, I don't think they were overjoyed, no. But I mean, the morale was very high. Well, I can only really speak for myself and the other company with me at that particular time. What the people were like back in Port Sudan doing garrison duties or not, I think the morale was okay, but I wouldn't have thought they were absolutely tickled to death. My chaps were very, very pleased to be in those hills. They had a lot of fun. And we used to go in the evening to have expeditions. We used to have expeditions down to the coast, down Suakin there. We used to go shark fishing, hire a boat, get a lamp on front. The soldiers, I mean, it's tickled to death, you see. A certain amount of fishing, a certain amount of potting and game.
And so these leisure activities were all basically fairly healthy,
oh,
and
yes,
sporting.
Yeah.
Can I go on from that to ask you about discipline? I would assume what you said about morale, that discipline was basically good.
Very good, no problem at all. I mean, they very little, like, you know, other than a private soldier telling an NCO to get stuffed or something like that, there was nothing. Mm. I mean, there was no place they could go and really...
No, to go and get drunk or into trouble.
I mean, we had... it was awfully... We were very, very short of anything in the way of nappy stores, because as I told you, Suakin to Port Sudan, there was a track, and when that part of that track got flooded, as it did when the Red Sea rains started and it came down into these wadis, there was an area of something in the region of about 3,000 yards of ground there, which was a flood, and you couldn't get any vehicle at all, because it was a mud flat where they used to plant cotton. And the track went through it. And when those rains came down there, your vehicle stopped. On one side, you had to get your stuff onto camels to get across the other side and then load onto vehicles again. And it's very difficult to keep up your ration supply, much less any goodies. And so there wasn't an awful lot of naffy stuff there.
What did you do about food? I mean, you mentioned there was game about. Could you supplement the rations by local purchase as well as by shooting the occasional...
Well, we shot the odd gazelle down there. Now, the other... Pollington, who commanded the other company there, he was a brilliant shot. I mean, he was a marksman par excellence. He was a chap who'd been promoted, because this is where we... had to do a certain from the ranks. Namely, he was a sergeant major in 1939, and he got promoted and got commissioned. And because of his amount of service, I think he was promoted direct to being a captain, made a captain straight away. And he commanded the other company, Pollington. Now, he was a member of our weapon training staff. He was a brilliant shot. And, I mean, he got a gazelle. Well, now, that sort of carved up and distributed to the companies. I mean, it didn't go awfully far, but fresh meat. But we didn't do too badly from the ration point of view. One didn't do not very well from the luxuries point of view.
And what about drink? I mean, was it just a question of...
Lucky when you got it. Easy as that. I mean, the soldier got the odd bottle of beer. The Saddam, funnily enough, had a beer called Iwo. And that was made in the Republic of China, well, what was then China. And when I first went into the Red Sea Hotel in Port Sudan, I asked for a bottle of beer, I got a bottle of Chinese beer. Extraordinary. And we got a lot of bits of this in the Naffy stores that came through. So we just got a bottle of beer when there was one. I mean, I can't honestly remember how often we got it. We got the odd bottle of whiskey, the officers, the sergeant's mess.
How many of you were there in the officers' mess in this camp?
Including the Carabatoon officers, the two Carabatoon officers, I suppose there must have been about 30. Okay.
You mentioned
possibly not quite as many because there were some out on patrol and various things like that.
You mentioned you had to betray to promote men from the ranks to become officers. Did this cause any friction or difficulty?
Didn't cause any friction, no. I think one or two other officers browned off because they suddenly found a chap who was Sergeant Major 1 week, was commissioned. He didn't mind that a bit, but he found that later on, in actual fact, in seniority, the chap who'd just been commissioned was senior to him because of the question of service that came into it. And that caused a little thing. I think they didn't think of anything. I think it was, they just sort of said, oh, hell. You know, I thought it was rather a funny way of doing things. That's all. There's no umbrage, no. They were jolly good chaps, actually. We were very careful when we did. Every one of them was excellent.
And they found it quite an easy transition?
I think they found it a bit difficult to start with. They didn't know what sort of reception they might get, but it was a very easy transition. Because, I mean, there were, at the time, I think there was Wellington Dawson Day. There were four initially, increased later to six. And they were all extremely good chaps, frightfully good.
Who actually decided, was it the commanding officer of the battalion who decided that they were the chaps he wanted to promote?
Yes. Yeah. So it was, basically, really.
It's all really a matter of local knowledge there.
Oh, yes, indeed.
How is your company organised?
Well, we didn't. Three platoons, company headquarters, with the attachments at company headquarters of signalers, and what else? Oh, then, of course, one had other attachments, perhaps part of the section of mortars or something like that. But that was basically it.
But they were under command rather than...
Yeah, under command, yes. Under command.